On this episode of the Playbook, I have Alan Smolinski, entrepreneur and one of the owners of the world champion Los Angeles Dodgers. And we're going to talk about how important it is not only to tell your kids what to do, but to show them what to do, to work long and hard towards what they want. Nobody's done it better than Alan Smolinski, owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Join me for all of this and more on The Playbook.
This is Entrepreneurs The Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host, David Meltzer.
I have the owner, one of the owners of an incredible group of owners of the number one team, I think, in the world. It definitely is the number one team in baseball, and they proved it after 20 years. Alan Smolinski, he is the entrepreneur and one of the owners of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Welcome to the Playbook.
Thank you very much for having me. I love that intro. I agree. It's the number one sports team in the world, so thank you for that.
Well, I'm from Southern California. Many friends and clients have played for your organization, and it is stellar from the top down, from ownership down, and has been historically that way. So it's, you know, even if it's not the team itself that you root for, the organization is extraordinary. Now, I want to take us back, because everybody dreams that can't play of owning a team. You know, it's beyond, you know, I know guys want to be a manager, they want to be a general manager, but I've always wanted to be an owner. I've been blessed to have a small portion of an option in different sports to be an owner and even a commissioner. But when you're young, what was your aspiration as far as sports went?
Yeah, so I grew up in an immigrant family, and both my parents were immigrants from Argentina, but they fully embraced America and really assimilated quickly and had us playing every single sport. So I played football, baseball, basketball, soccer, tennis, I mean, anything with a ball. And I was really competitive. So I think probably until about 12, the idea was, oh, I could play for the Dodgers. I could play for the Lakers. I'm the man at the schoolyard, you know. And maybe when I started high school, I went to a large high school, 3,000 people, incredible sports, put people in the NBA and the NFL, and a few into MLB. And I think it was very quick that I realized there, okay, that's not going to happen. But so from that point forward, I would always watch that trophy ceremony, and you'd sort of see that shorter guy who's a little bald and a little out of shape. And he's like half in the scene, you know, with the big trophy. And I was like, who's that guy? Maybe I could do that, because I like numbers. I like math. I like him. And he looks good, and his wife looks beautiful, and you know, the family looks great. I want to be that guy. So I think that was always in the back of my head, you know.
And you ended up going to USC. You didn't play sports at USC.
No way.
you studied music.
Yeah.
Right. And why music?
So I was first in my family to go to college, and I didn't have a phenomenal social experience at USC. I wasn't in the fraternity or sorority system, and so I wasn't the most popular guy. And in my freshman dorms, I had started a business. So I was working so hard on this business and not loving the college experience to begin with. But dropping out wasn't really an option, because no one had ever had the opportunity to go to college. So I was like, I needed to do this. And so I switched from business to music, because I'd always loved music. I'd played piano, and it was much easier major to get through than business. And also, business was so theoretical. It was like that scene from Back to School, Rodney Dangerfield, with this professor up there talking about all this theoretical garbage. And it just, you know, a classroom of 800 people, it didn't make any sense at all. Everybody was like, one out of two freshmen were business majors at USC. And that always bugged me. It made no sense. So I split off of that freshman year, and then ended up doing music so I could have more time in my business, and also so I could accelerate and graduate in three, not stay there and have more time to build a business.
Right. And building a real estate business was indicative. You know, I find as a child of an immigrant, we are more entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
You know, we came up, you have to be, when our parents come over, you have to be more entrepreneurial, because they have to figure out how are we going to feed our kids. And it's not easy. There's language barriers, there's economic disadvantages, education disadvantages. And so I know that pressure in my family was even worse because the fetus wasn't fully developed till after graduate school. So you'd have probably had to get a PhD in music before they let you make millions of dollars in real estate. Where and how, you know, great entrepreneurs see a need and fill it. How did you effectuate it though? You know, a lot of guys in college understand real estate, especially USC. I mean, this is the Orange County haven of realtors, you know, yet you were the one who figured out how to implement and to create a great business out of a housing shortage, which is consistent over the last 20 years of, you know, student housing and shortages of student housing, but not everyone can pull it off. And you've done extraordinarily well. What were some of the key elements of how you identified the opportunity and then took advantage of it?
Yeah, that's a great question, David, because I think about that all the time. Tens of thousands of students came through there, many with parents in real estate, many with access to capital, many who saw the same thing I did and did nothing about it. So I was always entrepreneurial. I did lemonade stands. I started businesses in high school. I sold lollipops around. You know, my dad was my hero. He was like Superman to me. And he started his own company about 15 years after coming to America. And it was a small garment business, not too far from Dodger Stadium. And so I think that was always in my head. I wanted to be like him. I wanted to control my own destiny. And so I saw this opportunity because my best friend said, where are you going to live next school year when we were in the dorms? And I was like, dude, we've been here like 60 days. How the hell do I know where I'm living next year? He goes, dude, if you don't find an apartment now, you are homeless because USC is going to house the freshmen and then they throw you out and that's it. And if you don't have your apartment, you know, by March or before spring break starts, you're toast. So I said, where do you live? He says, well, there's this Chinese guy. He owns a couple good buildings. He takes really good care of them. It's over on Shrine behind where they used to do the Academy Awards at the Shrine Auditorium. I said, great, let's go see him. So he introduces me and he says, great. We start leasing, you know, on February 6th and, you know, get your sleeping bag out, start sleeping outside February 4th. You know, maybe you'll get an apartment. And I thought he was joking because I remember hearing stories like in the 60s for Yankees tickets, you'd sleep outside, yeah, you know, for days and days outside the stadium. But it was true. And so we slept outside for two nights and I'm just sitting there thinking, you know, the two bedroom is the same as the price for a two bedroom in Beverly Hills. I have to sleep outside for 2 days. Look at all this demand. At the time, I'd never met anybody in real estate. I never knew anybody in real estate. I never heard of anybody in real estate. No one in the family was in it. So it wasn't like, oh, I got to be in real estate. This is the industry that speaks to me. It was just business, just seeing an opportunity. And so I started hanging around in my landlord's office all day, every day. Also an immigrant, also parents that were, you know, beyond poor, like not enough food poor the way my parents were. And so we completely hit it off, even though, you know, we grew up on opposite sides of the world. And I just kept telling him, you got to build, you got to add, you got to grow this business. You got people sleeping outside. And he was just like, well, I heard in China, some people ran into material shortages, got into trouble with the bank, didn't know how to finish the property, and they got a lot of trouble. I said, look, I'll figure this whole thing out. You put up some of the money. Let me do all the work. I'm going to figure out how to do this. And I just started drawing maps every night after class, drawing maps of the whole neighborhood, figuring out the land, and sort of took it from there.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. And then one of the key components or common denominators in the playbook to success is always what I call the desire that you must be what you can be, combined with consistent, persistent behavior. And your dad especially sounds like someone that was a 6 or 7 day a week laborer, and he was not afraid of hard work and long work, which are two different things. I always say people don't mind hard, they really mind long.
And so true. Yeah.
And but you want, you know, your dad could tell you to work hard. You're never going to listen. But when you see your parents do everything they can to feed you, my mom was a single mom with six kids, packed my dinner in a paper bag, taught us in a station. I filled up turnstiles at the 7-Eleven with greeting cards just so her five boys and one girl could eat. She never had to tell me to work hard. Right. I get choked up thinking about it.
Yeah, me too.
There's no quit. How much of that, you know, work ethic is attributed to your success beyond recognizing an opportunity and, you know, following through and implementing? How much is just the plain old, hard, long work?
Yeah. So I was at a shareholder meeting in 2010. We were pregnant with our first child And it was Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner, was on stage answering questions. And a guy says, "Hey, we just had our first child. It's a boy. I want him to work hard. I want him to have the morals. I want him to appreciate this country and the opportunity. I want him to be a good person and tell the truth." And Charlie Munger just looked at him and said, "It's not what you say, it's what they see." Next question. That was his whole answer. And I thought, that's the greatest parenting advice I've ever heard in my life. My dad never said, work hard, tell the truth, treat people fairly. My dad never said any of that. I just saw him do it every day. I mean, he started sweeping floors for $1.25 an hour. You know, didn't speak a word of English. I mean, he just worked his ass off. And so it's never been like a struggle, like, oh, we have to work so hard. But the second thing is if you're really passionate about it, it doesn't feel like work. So when we built the business, it was 16 to 18 hour days. I slept on the couch in my office. I wore the same thing to work every day for 8 years. But it was so much fun. It was so great. You know, my partner and I weren't like, oh my God, we're working so hard. Oh, we're not dating or we're not seeing movies. We're like, we're building something. This is amazing. And everybody we were hiring was really excited and passionate and young and aggressive. And it was so much fun looking back on that time.
And, you know, you were able to amass a couple $100 million in an exit in 2008, which is
that
great.
Works out.
Yeah, that works out great. And you deserve it. But more importantly, we talked about the sign behind me. And, you know, I talked about money doesn't buy happiness or love. But if you shop, it does allow you to shop. And a couple $100 million allow you to shop. I shopped on the wrong things. I lost over $100 million in real estate. And luckily, that taught me some. I called it my biggest investment, because what dummy tax I paid has catapulted me here to where I am today. But more importantly, you're shopping for the right things. And, you know, you bought a newspaper with a reason and a purpose, and you buy the Dodgers and your ownership in there for a reason and the purpose. When you're taking inventory of shopping for big items, you know, to shop for the right things, because we don't want to buy things to impress other people, especially people we don't like. But when we're buying things, you know, community centers and other philanthropic things that we buy, there has to be a true why behind it. What was your inner why for the newspaper and the Dodgers that really drove you to make that big investment?
Yeah, so that's a great point. So I'd never met anybody or really knew people that were like really, really wealthy. I always tell my wife, like, we're sitting here in our vacation home. I tell my wife, I never met anybody who had a vacation home. I never knew a single person. Do you know anybody? Like, who the hell is a vacation home? And so it was, I didn't know what to expect. When we sold the company, we were incredibly lucky. I mean, the buyer had all this money that was non-refundable 3 days before Lehman Brothers failed. Then the financial crisis came in 08. And we're like, wow, that timing really worked out. And we thought, okay, the world will end. We'll be able to buy all this real estate. So we'll just start another company. But sort of the government came in and bailed everything out. There wasn't a ton of opportunity. So my partner moved back to Asia. I had gone from working 18-hour days to like just sort of hanging out. And I wasn't happy. And I ended up in therapy. I did antidepressants that year because I had my first son and I was like, not
at least you didn't lose your money. I went the other direction. I had nothing to do and I lost my money. That was the worst. You were smart. A couple of pills, fine.
Yeah, no, but I went deep into therapy to sort of figure myself out, and like, because it was never a second to breathe the previous 11 years as we were building the business. And so you're right. At the time, it was all the money in the world and incredibly unhappy. And so I, you know, worked through that. And then it was like, okay, so I want to go back to work. I want to build something. I want it to be great. And so I made a list of like my 5 or 10 favorite companies, businesses, assets in the world. Dodgers, of course, was on the list, but that was not obtainable 11 years ago. But the Palisadian Post newspaper was my favorite newspaper. It was a 91-year-old subscription newspaper that had never missed a Thursday of publishing through 2 world wars, famine, fires, floods, Great Depression. Like, you know, people read this paper religiously in my town. I have never missed an issue of this paper. And so I thought that'd be a fun thing to do. It's not going to move the needle. It's not going to make a lot of money, but this would be really neat. And we did it. And we solved a murder in our first year. We won some incredible prizes. We did all this great stuff. And it was so much fun. It also kind of speaks to me because I'm kind of like to challenge authority and keep an eye on things. And I don't believe a lot of things. I'm quite cynical. And so we you know, we found this kind of Bernie Madoff guy in town and ran him out of town. And so I really, that stuff really appealed to me. And we still have the paper, and it's the most fun I've ever had losing money, but it doesn't lose a lot of money. So, you know, it was one of those things. And it got me going back to work, because for the first couple of years I was there every day. It was sort of reorganizing the paper and how are we going to make it sustainable with the internet and this kind of stuff.
You know, as you know, we finish up, one of the key components to success is mentorship and asking for help. And my biggest, people ask me all the time, what was the thing that was the catalyst? How could you lose all that money? I said, I didn't ask anyone for help. I was listening to everyone around me tell me how smart and great and Midas-like I was. And I started to believe all the yes people. Steve Hertz wrote that great book, right? Don't take yes for an answer. That's all I took for answers, including from my wife. And I was miserable. You know, unfortunately, I didn't ask for help when I was miserable. You know, if I always said I thought therapists were stupid and too expensive. Now I have over $100 million on a golf course, a ski mountain. I got 33 homes in San Diego, and I'm worried about paying a therapist to, you know, deal with the fact that I'm miserable and everyone thinks I'm the lucky. I'm running the most notable sports agency in the world with all these three daughters under 10, gorgeous, healthy daughters, an unbelievable wife who I've outkicked my coverage, and I'm sitting there crying in bed, depressed and not asking for help. And instead go through, you know, what a lot of people do, self-sabotage and not paying attention. And, you know, fortunately, my wife saved me and was the help that I needed to rebound. For you, was there an ego play about asking for help, or were you always open to you know, asking for help and being humble in that manner? Because I wasn't.
No, so that's a great point. I think the difference between really great entrepreneurs and really successful people is that they learn that lesson early. Very few people, I think, have that naturally. But, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed by some of my conduct in my early 20s and the way I talked to some people, you know, because it was like, wow, I made a couple million bucks. I'm 6 months out of school. I'm so great. Look at me. I'm so smart. I mean, the way I conducted meetings and certain things. And so now I read about Silicon Valley guys, you know, and I kind of feel sympathy for some of them. Because it's like they have so much success. They're told that they're such geniuses at such a young age. And now I'm the complete opposite, right? Now yeah. I'm like, no, I don't understand. I'm so dumb. Let me try and figure this out. And it's just such a different mindset. And I think the really big money we've made, the really great success we've had has been in those later years when you're so, you know, questioning everything and you're not overconfident and arrogance. Oh God, what could be more unattractive? It's just the worst, and it'll kill you in business too. I think back then I was like you. I would not have reached out for help. I knew everything. Oh, I was so smart. Look at me. How many guys are so successful? And then now later, I reach out for help all the time. I, even from people I don't know, and especially from my wife. So you can't be afraid to reach out. I mean that is. You know, and getting mentors. I mean, you'd be surprised how many great mentors there are out there that will take time out of their life. Super accomplished people, amazing people, strangers. If you write them a note, tell them what you're up to. Can you help me on the phone? Can we do a quick Zoom? How many people will say yes? And so, you know, if there's something I could have told myself back then is I could have saved a lot of heartache by trying to talk to some more of the bigger guys that have been around longer that I knew were really good philanthropic guys. And gravitated less towards the sort of flashier ego guys.
Well, I think you make the greatest point there is that, you know, 9 out of 10 of the most successful people that you'll want to meet or want to mentor you did not do it on their own. They've learned that lesson of radical humility, like you and I have, to ask for help. And so people like us are more willing to help because we know without those people in our lives, we would never be where we are. We want to pay it forward. So you're better off asking someone that's not aspirational, that's someone that's already where you want to go, and just ask them for directions. 9 out of 10 of them, they absolutely will bend over backwards, and they don't see a separation of ego anymore. So they only feel a philanthropic and empathetic nature of, man, I really want to invest in this kid. He reminds me of myself when I was 24.
And I love finding people that remind me of myself. I love that. We have an oil and gas partnership business right now, and I see these two young guys. I'm like, man, they're saying the same things I used to say. Look how fired up they are. You know, not married, no kids, no pets. They're going to work all day, every day. I was like, they're so much like I was. So yeah, I get excited when I meet people like that.
Well, I'm excited that I got to meet you, and I look forward to hopefully next season sharing a game with you and getting to know you even better. You've done extraordinary work. So proud, and I'm sure your parents as well, of showing what America truly is the land of opportunity, and that we can't forget that it's still the only place that your parents can come from somewhere else and you can end up owning the number one sports franchise in the world.
Exactly,
one short lifetime. It's an incredible place. This is Dave Meltzer, Making Dreams Without Money, and the great Alan Smolinski, the owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Playbook as much as me. On a personal note, I just wanted to thank everyone for making The Playbook such a success. Don't forget to continue it by sharing, subscribing, and listening to your favorite episodes. This is Dave Meltzer with The Playbook.